others who have done more than I. But if you insist on an answer, let me call your attention to the impetus that has been given to the building of skyscrapers since my associates uncovered more economical and better methods of producing steel. You know, of course, that the modern skyscraper would be an impossibility without the use of the steel frame. The skyscraper would also be an economic impossibility if steel were as expensive as it was when I entered the business of manufacturing steel. We have given the country a better product than any it knew before we entered the business of making steel, and we have brought prices down to where steel can be substituted for the less satisfactory products of wood and other metals of less durability. When I first entered the steel business, steel, such as it was, sold for around $130 per ton. We brought it down to around $20 per ton. Moreover, we so improved the quality that steel now serves scores of uses for which it was not suited until we improved it.
Was your major motive that of making money, Mr. Carnegie?
No. My major motive always has been that of making men more useful to themselves and to others. As you may have heard, I have had the privilege of making millionaires of more than 40 men, most of them men who began working with me as ordinary laborers. But the money these men accumulated is not the important thing I wish to stress. In helping them to accumulate money, I helped them to become a great asset to this nation. By inspiring them to exercise their own initiative, I started them to rendering useful service that has contributed richly to the development of the great industrial system of America. You see, therefore, that these men became more than owners of riches. They became intelligent users of riches, and as such they provided employment for many thousands of men. Wealth consists in material things and human experience properly mixed. The most important part of that mixture is brains, experience, personal initiative, and the desire to build and create. Without these qualities, money would be useless. Understand this truth, and you will have a better knowledge of the nature of our American riches. We are a rich nation because we have a great number of pioneers whose pride of personal achievement has enticed them to exercise their right of individual initiative in all forms of business and industrial activity. These men may think they were motivated by the desire for personal riches, but the truth is that they were influenced by the much greater desire for personal achievement. Regardless of the motives by which they were actuated, they have helped to convert a vast wilderness into the world's richest and most progressive nation. This could not have been accomplished without the free, voluntary exercise of the personal initiative of the men who did the job.
What part has the American form of government served in the development of American industry, Mr. Carnegie?
A very necessary part indeed. If you will read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, you will see clearly that the men who wrote those profound documents clearly intended to surround the people of America with every conceivable right and opportunity for the free exercise of personal initiative. Under no other form of government do men receive such definite encouragement to exercise their personal initiative.
Then you see no reason for changing our form of government?
Not unless we find still better ways of influencing men to take possession of their own minds and use their abilities on their own initiative. Our form of government is not perfect, but it is the best the world has yet discovered. It provides far greater liberties and privileges for the use of personal initiative than the majority of men are using intelligently. Why change it until the people of America catch up with it by using the opportunities it provides? Tinkering with things that serve satisfactorily is one trait that gets men into difficulty. This is one form of personal initiative that should be discouraged. It comes under the heading of meddlesome curiosity. If a man has good health, he should go about his business and not interfere with nature by experimenting with cures of diseases with which he does not suffer. However, there are some who do not follow this rule. They're known as hypochondriacs, and they are always suffering with imaginary illness. We are in a healthy economic condition in this country. We have vastly greater undeveloped resources than any we are using. Let us not experiment with our economic system, but rather let us make more intelligent use of our present system, to the end that we may make better uses of our great resources. Nations that are always experimenting with their systems of government and their economic systems are engaged in revolutions and counter-revolutions most of their time. No small part of our success here in America is due to the spirit of harmonious relationship existing between the state and the union. That harmony is the direct result of our form of government, which wisely provides an incentive for harmony among the people. In union, there is strength. This is true of business and industrial groups the same as it is in the relationship between the states.
What do you believe to be the greatest possible evil that might curtail the success of the American people as a whole?
Anything that would in any way weaken the spirit of harmony between the people. Our unity of purpose is our greatest national asset. It is vastly more important than all our natural resources, for without this, we would become the victims of any greedy nation that might wish to take our natural resources away from us. We fought a tragic war among our own people to maintain our national unity. While memories of this war linger in the minds of some, now we all recognize that a separation of the states would have meant the beginning of our disintegration. And I might well add that the greatest evil that can overtake an industry or a business is that which disturbs the harmonious working relationship between those engaged in it. Business succeeds through the friendly cooperation of those engaged in it. Personal initiative is a powerful good only when men combine their experience and ability and work toward a common end in a spirit of harmony and understanding.
Then you do not look with favor on those who make it their business to stir up strife, hatred, and envy among men who are engaged in the operation of the American industrial system?
No. This is a form of personal initiative which may help some, but it destroys the rights of many. In our own industry, I have never had any misunderstanding with those who work for me except that which was inspired by professional agitators who profit by disturbing human relationships. That is the worst of all forms of personal initiative. How could I have had any misunderstanding with men who, down to the humblest worker, knew that the door of opportunity was wide open day and night to those who wished to earn more by making themselves worth more? The man who helps wage earners to rise from day labor to become millionaires, as I have done whenever I've had the opportunity, is not likely to have any misunderstanding with his men if he is left alone to deal with them on the basis of free enterprise.
But, Mr. Carnegie, are there not some employers who do not take such a constructive attitude regarding their relationship with their employees? Are there not some employers who greedily clamor for more than their share of what their business produces?
Yes, there are some such. There always have been. There will always be men of greed. But they do not last. Competition soon eliminates them. That is one of the benefits of the system of free enterprise under which we operate in America. Here, an employer must make good or make room, and he cannot make good at the expense of his employees. His competitors see to that.
When and under what circumstances should one begin to exercise personal initiative?
The time to begin using personal initiative is immediately following one's definite decision as to what one wishes to accomplish. The time to begin is right then. The place to begin is right where one stands. The time to act is now. Lay out a plan for acquiring your goal, prepare to give an equivalent value for it, and begin then and there to put the plan into action. If the plan chosen turns out to be weak, it can be changed for a better one. But any sort of plan is better than procrastination. The universal evil of the world is procrastination. the terrible habit people have of waiting for the time to begin something to be just right. It causes more failures than all the weak plans of the world.
But shouldn't one consult others and get their opinions before beginning important plans?
Now listen here, young fellow. Opinions are like the sands of the desert, and most of them are about as slippery. Everyone has an opinion about practically everything, but most of them are unworthy of trust. The man who hesitates because he wants the opinions of others before he begins to exercise his personal initiative usually winds up by doing nothing. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule. There are times when the counsel and advice of others are absolutely essential for success. But if you refer to idle opinions of bystanders, let them alone. Avoid them as you would an epidemic of disease, for that is exactly what idle opinions are, a disease. Everyone has a flock of them, and most people hand them out freely without being asked. If you want an opinion on which you can rely, consult the man who is known to be an authority on the subject in connection with which you seek an opinion. Pay him for his counsel, but avoid free opinions because they are generally worth exactly what one pays for them. I recall quite clearly what some acquaintances of mine said when they heard I was planning to cut the price of steel to $20 a ton. "He'll go broke," they shouted. They gave me free advice without my seeking it. I passed it by and went ahead with my plans. Steel came down to $20 a ton. When Henry Ford announced he would give the people a dependable automobile for less than $1,000, they shouted, "He'll go broke." But Ford went ahead with his plans, and one day he will be the dominating factor in one of America's greatest industries. And he'll not go broke. When Columbus announced that he would sail his little boats across an uncharted ocean and discover a new route to India, the doubting Thomases cried out, "He's crazy! He'll never come back!" But he did come back. When Copernicus announced he had invented an instrument for which he had revealed hidden worlds never before seen by the human eye, these same free opinion fellows hooted, "Heretic, put him to the torch." They actually wanted to burn him for daring to use his own initiative. When Alexander Graham Bell announced he had invented a telephone with which people could talk to one another at long distance by the use of wires, the unbelievers yelled, "Poor Alex has gone crazy." But Bell went ahead with his idea and perfected it, although the time did not appear to be just right. And you'll have your turn with these free opinion boys who spend their time trying to discourage men from using their own initiative. You'll hear them cry out, "He can't do it. He can't give the world a philosophy of individual achievement because no one has ever done it before." But if you take my advice, you will go right ahead and back your judgment on your own initiative. When you succeed, as succeed you will, the world will crown you with glory and lay its treasures at your feet. But not until you have taken the risk and have proved your ideas sound. Don't become discouraged because other people may tell you, "The time is not right." The time is always right for the man who knows what he wants and goes to work to get it. The world needs a philosophy of individual achievement. It has always needed such a philosophy. Go ahead and supply that need, no matter how long it takes or what sacrifices you may have to make to do the job. Do the job the best you can, and you'll learn from first-hand experience that these calamity howlers are nothing but a bunch of disappointed human beings who are suffering with an inferiority complex because they have neglected to use their own initiative.
That was quite a speech, Mr. Carnegie, and I take it for granted that you meant it mostly for me.
Yes, I meant it for you, and through your efforts I hope it will serve the yet unborn generations long after I shall have passed on. The world needs men who have the courage to act on their own initiative. Moreover, men of this type write their own price tag, and the world willingly pays it. The world willingly rewards men of initiative. The privilege of personal initiative is an important part of the American way of life, but the privilege is worth nothing if it is not exercised. What we need most here in the United States is a continuous sales campaign for the sole purpose of keeping the American people inspired, with a desire to take advantage of the opportunities available for the accumulation of riches. The government should conduct a continuous campaign designed entirely to bring to the attention of the people the nature and scope of the opportunities available to them.
Then you believe there are still enough opportunities for individual success in the United States to go around to all the people?
Yes. There is an opportunity to match the ambition and the ability of every person in the United States. But opportunity will not hunt the man. The order must be reversed through organized individual endeavor. The greatest opportunities will be available to those who are the most capable of organizing and directing their own efforts.
Some may not understand what is meant by the term organized individual endeavor. Would you define your understanding of this principle?
The principle of organized individual endeavor consists of a very definite procedure through which an individual may promote himself into whatever station he desires or acquire whatever material things he wishes. The steps to be taken are these. 1. Choice of a definite purpose or objective. 2. Creation of a plan for the attainment of the objective. 3. Continuous action in carrying out the plan. 4. Alliance with those who will cooperate in carrying out the plan. 5. Moving at all times on one's own initiative. Organized individual endeavor might be briefly described as planned action. Any action based on a definite plan has a better chance of success than an effort of an unorganized, haphazard nature, such as that in which the majority of people engage. Able leadership, without organized individual endeavor, is an impossibility. The two major points of difference between a leader and a follower are these. 1. The leader carefully plans his efforts, and 2. He moves on his own initiative without being told to do so. If you wish to find a potential leader, look around until you find a man who makes his own decisions, plans his own work, and carries out his plans on his own initiative. In such a man, you will see the major requirements for leadership. This is the type of man who pioneered in American industry, and to him we owe the credit for the great American industrial system, which is the envy of the world.
But what about the quality of genius? Aren't the leaders in industry and business blessed with some form of genius which most people do not possess, Mr. Carnegie?
Now you are talking about a fallacy that has deceived more people than any other mistaken idea. The word genius is badly overworked. It is generally used to explain successful achievement because most people do not take the time to dig in and find out how men succeed. Personally, I do not know what a genius is. I have never seen one. But I have seen many successful men who are called geniuses. Analysis of the cause of their success would show that they are only average men who have discovered and applied certain rules which enable them to get from where they started to where they wish to go. Every normal person has within him the potentiality of that which we call genius in one field of endeavor or another, depending upon the individual's preferences, his inborn traits of character, and his ambition. I would say that the nearest quality to genius that I could describe is an obsessional desire to do some one thing and do it well, plus the willingness to act on one's own initiative. From this point on, genius is only a matter of organized individual endeavor persistently carried out. The man who knows precisely what he wants and is determined to get it is about the nearest approach to that which some call genius that I can think of. Such a man has better than an average chance of success, and when he achieves success, The world is apt to look at him in the hour of his triumph and attribute his achievements to what they believe to be genius.
But, Mr. Carnegie, doesn't the question of education enter into one's personal achievements? Isn't it true that the educated man has a better chance of success than the man who lacks education?
That depends altogether on what you mean by the term education. There is no doubt that an educated man has a better chance of success than one who is not educated. But let us define the word educate. The word means to develop the mind from within, to educe, to draw out, to expand. It does not mean, as is popularly believed, the mere accumulation of facts. Many men are schooled, but few men are educated. An educated man is one who has learned how to use his mind so that he can get everything he desires without violating the rights of others. Education, therefore, comes from experience and use of the mind, and not merely from the acquisition of knowledge. Knowledge is of no value unless and until it is expressed in some form of useful service. Here is where the subject of personal initiative begins to prove its importance as an essential of success. To answer your question more specifically, an educated man has a better chance of success than one who is not educated only in the event that he applies his education in the achievement of some definite objective. All too often, men rely upon their possession of knowledge to take the place of organized individual endeavor. They expect to be paid for that which they know instead of that which they do with their knowledge. This point is important. I have heard it said that some successful businessmen hesitate to employ men who have just graduated from college, for the reason that many college graduates have too much they must unlearn before they become useful in the practical affairs of business. Speaking for myself, I would much prefer a college-trained man for positions of responsibility, but I prefer them to come to me with an open mind, seeking more knowledge. I prefer those who have a sound knowledge of fundamentals rather than the tricks of the trade. I prefer those who know the difference between theory and practice. There is one great advantage that most college graduates have over those who lack this training, and it is the fact that college training helps one to organize his knowledge. Disorganized knowledge is of very little value.
Do you believe that alertness in the application of individual initiative is an inborn trait? That one has it or doesn't have it according to the nature of his hereditary gifts?
My observation of people has forced me to the conclusion that personal initiative is largely based on personal desires and ambitions. The man who appears to have no individual initiative awakens and moves under his own initiative in a hurry when he becomes obsessed with some definite strong desire or purpose.
Would you say, then, that personal desire is the beginning of all individual achievements?
Yes, without a doubt. Definiteness of purpose is the result of desire. When a man's desires take on the proportion of an obsession, he usually begins to translate them into their physical equivalent through definiteness of purpose. Desire, therefore, is the starting point of all individual accomplishments. As far as I know, there is no impelling motive other than desire which inspires a man to move on his own initiative. Herein lies the secret of the influence some wives have over their husbands. When a man's wife desires riches or success, she may transplant that desire in the mind of her husband and cause him to move on it in a way that will enable him to succeed. I have often known of this happening. But in the last analysis, the desire for riches or success must become a definite motive on the part of the husband. The presence of a deeply seated desire in a man's mind has a tendency to stir him into action, as nothing else can do.
Then you believe it is true, as one philosopher expressed it, that men's faults consist in low aim and not in the stars.
There is nothing that will take the place of high aim. When a man sets his mind upon the achievement of a definite purpose, the powers of the universe appear to be on his side. He begins to make use of every available means to attain the object of his desires. The first thing that comes to his aid is his right to the exercise of individual initiative. Personal desires can be attained only by the exercise of personal initiative. If initiative takes on the form of organized individual endeavor, one's chances of success are greatly multiplied. When you analyze individual achievement in this manner, you learn quickly enough that no great achievement is possible without the application of organized individual endeavor. The use of this principle for the attainment of one's desires is not optional. It is imperative.
From your analysis of organized individual endeavor, I assume that this principle can be applied by the man with little schooling as well as by the man with extensive schooling. That it is not essentially a part of one's education in the popular interpretation of the meaning of the word education.
Lest you become confused on this point, let me make it clear that no man is educated in the true meaning of that term until he acquires a practical working knowledge of the principle of organized individual endeavor. Moving in an orderly, well-organized manner toward a definite end is precisely the procedure of an educated person. Go back to the definition of the word education and study it carefully. You will observe that the application of education leaves no alternative other than that of action based on organized individual endeavor. You might properly say that organized individual endeavor is education.
From your remarks, I reached the conclusion that the so-called self-made man is an individual who has learned how to organize his efforts and direct them to a definite end.
Yes, that describes the self-made man very well. You could have added the word persistence to your description, for it is a well-known fact that self-made men have the quality of persistence. In fact, all successful men carry out their plans with persistence. Without this quality, the principle of organized individual endeavor may not bring success.
It would be correct, then, to say that success is attained by definiteness of purpose expressed through the persistent application of organized individual endeavor?
That is the idea exactly. Moreover, if you analyze the meaning carefully, you will find nothing whatsoever about genius being essential for success. Almost anyone can make up his mind what he wants, create a plan for acquiring it, and proceed on his own initiative to carry out the plan. The only genius associated with this procedure is the necessary persistence to ensure continuous action in carrying out the plan. If one is motivated by a desire which assumes the proportion of an obsession, the important factor of persistence is not difficult to acquire.
Mr. Carnegie, you have used the word obsession quite frequently. Will you explain the nature of what you call an obsessional desire? Is this a state of mind?
Yes, an obsessional desire is a state of mind, and it is associated with the dominating thoughts of the mind. You might say that an obsessional desire is a form of self-hypnosis in that it occupies one's mind a major portion of his time. Successful men have the habit of focusing their attention upon the ways and means of achieving the object of their major purpose so continuously that this habit becomes a form of self-hypnosis. This habit develops self-reliance, initiative, imagination, and enthusiasm, and leads to action based on organized individual endeavor. Obsessional desire has the effect of transferring to the subconscious mind a clear, definite picture of that which one wants. Through some power which science has not as yet isolated and no one understands, the subconscious mind goes to work on such pictures by inspiring one with new ideas and practical plans for the realization of desires.
You would say then that self-hypnosis is not a dangerous habit?
The answer to that depends entirely upon the subject in connection with which self-hypnosis is practiced. I have known men who hypnotize themselves with the acceptance of poverty and failure and defeat. I have known others who hypnotize themselves with an obsessional desire for constructive achievement. I think I can safely say that no man has ever achieved great success without having been motivated by an obsessional desire that assumed the proportion of self-hypnosis. Here let me call your attention to the fact that there is a strange, unknown power connected with hypnosis which enables those under its influence to perform seemingly impossible feats. When under the influence of hypnosis, a man can lift a weight he could not even budge in his normal state of mind. There are some forms of disease which yield readily to treatment under hypnosis. There are physicians who specialize in the treatment of certain mental disorders through the application of hypnotism. Their method of treatment is known as suggestive therapeutics. It often serves to eliminate disease where nothing else will. Psychoanalysis is a method of psychotherapy resting on the theory, and it seems more than a mere theory, that abnormal mental reactions are due to repression of desires consciously rejected, but subconsciously persistent. One cannot dismiss the subject of hypnosis as being a mere superstition or a power to be feared. Our fears of the subject grow out of our ignorance of its nature and its possibilities for good. We should at least have no fear of self-hypnosis when it is applied to the achievement of worthy ends, and we need not know its complete nature or purpose in order to make helpful use of it. I'm very glad you brought up the subject of self-hypnosis, for you have given me an opportunity to express what I hope may be helpful suggestions in connection with its use. Names we give to things often frighten people. This is true of the word hypnosis. Some people are afraid of it because they associate it with black magic and the work of charlatans who have used hypnotism as a means of taking advantage of people. Let me offer this one word of encouragement concerning the power of hypnotism. No person can hypnotize another against his will. All hypnotism is, in the final analysis, self-hypnosis. It is a state of mind which can be produced only with the cooperation of the individual who is hypnotized. I know a man who is the recognized leader of a great industry. He founded the industry and he has grown wealthy through its successful operation. Knowing this man as well as I do, I would say that if anyone offered to hypnotize him, he would be highly insulted. He might even become frightened at the very mention of the word hypnotism. Yet I am prepared to tell you that his success is the result of self-hypnosis. He has been hypnotizing himself through his obsessional desires in connection with his business without knowing what he was doing. The same could be said of other successful men. Disabuse your mind, therefore, of any feeling that self-hypnosis associated with constructive obsessional desire is dangerous. The very opposite is true. We speak of autosuggestion without associating with it any feeling of fear. As a matter of fact, we accept the principle of autosuggestion as an essential for successful achievement. The principle of autosuggestion, suggestions we make to ourselves, is nothing but a mild form of self-hypnosis. Again, let me say that we become confused too often by the names we give to things. Doubtlessly, it would be a great surprise to men who suffer poverty and failure all their lives if they were told that their circumstances were self-imposed through the principle of self-hypnosis, but that would be near the truth. A man can hypnotize himself with fears and self-established limitations as easily as he can hypnotize himself with the obsessional desires for achievement. The subconscious mind accepts and acts upon the food with which it is fed. It goes to work on thoughts of poverty as quickly and as effectively as it accepts and acts upon thoughts of opulence. Let us not weigh these truths aside as being unworthy of consideration merely because we may not understand them.
It is your opinion, then, that both poverty and riches are a reflection of the individual's state of mind, that neither is the result of accident, luck, or other causes outside the control of the individual. Is that correct?
That states my belief perfectly. It is not a popular belief, because those who fail to acquire riches have the bad habit of looking everywhere except the right place for the cause of their failure. Many blame our economic system for their poverty, although this country is known the world over as the land of opportunity, and our form of government, our economic system, our American way of life are the envy of the rest of the world. The man who cannot accumulate riches in the United States could not accumulate them anywhere else, and for the reason that our entire setup is one which encourages individual accumulation of riches. The real cause of individual poverty in the United States is the failure of the individual to grasp the fundamental principles by which riches are acquired. Too many of our people are looking for handouts. They do not recognize the fact that there is no such reality as something for nothing, that riches begin in the form of a state of mind based on definiteness of purpose, plus a willingness to give something of value in return for riches.
Of course, you recognize that not all riches possessed by the American people are the result of a state of mind, and not all riches were earned by some of the people who possess them. Take, for example, the inherited fortunes. They came into possession of those who have them without anything of value being given in return, and without any relationship to the owner's state of mind.
I can see that you have not thought such circumstances through with sufficient accuracy. While it is true that inherited riches are not earned by those who possess them, and the riches have no relationship to the owner's state of mind, you must remember that this does not apply to those from whom the riches were inherited. Somebody, perhaps with a few rare exceptions, gave something of value in return for those riches, and their accumulation was very definitely related to the state of mind of the one who acquired them. There is another important fact in connection with inherited riches which I fear you have overlooked. Riches acquired in this manner soon go back into general distribution. That old saying that it takes only 3 generations for people to pass from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves is quite appropriate. Inherited fortunes seldom remain in the hands of heirs for more than 2 generations. Our entire economic system is so arranged that it absorbs unearned riches very quickly. There is another important fact in connection with inherited riches. Such riches usually soften those who receive them and destroy their ability to retain the riches. Here again, we have evidence that anything one acquires without giving something of equal value in return for it has a queer way of melting away. This applies to inherited riches, to money acquired by unlawful methods, and to all forms of ill-gotten gain. Moreover, this truth is known throughout the world. It appears that the whole universe is so planned that natural law frowns upon idleness, an empty head, and the desire to get something for nothing. This fact is significant if one will only take time to analyze it.
Please understand, Mr. Carnegie, that I am not trying to make out a case in favor of those who seek something for nothing or who inherit riches. I am merely trying to establish proof of the existence of an eternal justice that places everyone, as you have said, substantially where his own state of mind entitles him to be. Do you recognize the existence of such a system of universal justice?
Yes, I do recognize the existence of such a system. Every person who gives serious thought to cause and effect recognizes it. Emerson described it convincingly in his classic essay on compensation. There is a law of compensation through the operation of which every man may benefit if he adapts himself to the law. It does not favor any attempt to get something for nothing. It pays no premiums on idleness or indolence. And I specifically call your attention to the fact that under our American way of life, our industrial system, our economic system as a whole, and our form of government come as near to conforming to the law of compensation as it is humanly possible to make them. Let us see in what manner this is true. First, the entire American way of life is designed to give every man all the liberty and freedom he will appropriate and use so long as it is not attained at the expense of another. This privilege is guaranteed to every man by our form of government, a system of government which was created with that privilege as its major purpose. Second, our industrial and economic systems are so arranged than individuals who exercise their privilege of personal initiative by going the extra mile, are rewarded in proportion to the quality and quantity of service they render. Thus, under our system, every individual is given an adequate motive for adapting himself to the law of compensation. Third, our system is so arranged that our natural resources remain always available, not controlled or owned by the government or any individual or small group of individuals, and the right of free enterprise, which remains always open and available to the people as a whole, ensures such a general and frequent exchange of our various forms of riches that everyone has an opportunity to acquire a portion of them. Our system provides for a continuous turnover of capital and commodities and all other kinds of riches. In the process of this turnover, every individual who has something of value in services or otherwise to give may receive his just portion of the profits connected with the turnover. In the United States, one has not only that privilege, which he may exercise through his own personal initiative, but our entire American way of life beckons to him as a customer and makes it attractive and profitable for him to take for himself as much as he can justly earn. We do not frown upon men who, by their superior skill, education, and experience, so adapt themselves to the law of compensation that they accumulate great riches. Our system encourages men to acquire everything for which they are prepared to give something of an equivalent value. Thus you see that the American way of life was patterned to harmonize with one of nature's most inexorable laws. In this respect, the American way of life reflects the great wisdom of the men who patterned it. Any weaknesses we find in the American way of life are weaknesses of individuals who refuse or neglect to adapt themselves to its multiple advantages, and not weaknesses of the system. There is no escape from this conclusion.
Your logic seems to be irrefutable, Mr. Carnegie. How did you arrive at your conclusions concerning the wisdom with which the pattern makers of the American way of life arranged our system to harmonize with the law of compensation?
I was forced to this conclusion by observing the effects of the system in the practical affairs of industry and business. By comparing the American way of life with that of other countries, I had no choice but to recognize that ours is vastly superior to any other. Our standard of living is higher than that existing anywhere else. The opportunities for individual accumulation of riches are more extensive and varied here than in any other country. Our whole scheme of living is such that even a humble rail splitter, born in poverty and illiteracy, may aspire to the highest office within the gift of the people and get it. In no other country now existing, or that has ever been known to civilization, has such an opportunity been available to the people.
I assume from all you have said that you hold no brief for the man who complains that he has no chance to get ahead in this country.
No, I hold no brief for such a man. But I do have a feeling of deep sorrow for all who are so ill-informed as not to recognize that we are blessed with more benefits than any other people of the world. Ignorance is our greatest sin. It is my greatest hope that I may help to wipe out certain prominent kinds of ignorance in the United States by making books generally available, and specifically by giving the people a sound philosophy of individual achievement. I wish everyone to have plenty. I wish everyone to have a just share of the great riches of this country. But I know that riches can be of enduring value only to those who learn how to acquire them through their own initiative. Earned riches carry with them a certain amount of wisdom in the use of riches, which is never known to the person who inherits riches or acquires them in violation of the law of compensation.
You believe, I assume from your analysis, that the only sort of gift that may do no damage is the gift of practical knowledge?
There are three types of gifts which are safe. One is the gift of knowledge or the means to acquire it. Another is the sort with which every American citizen has been abundantly blessed. The gift of opportunity to share in the benefits available in the richest country in the world, through the exercise of the privilege of personal initiative and the right of free enterprise. These are priceless gifts, and they are of a nature that can do no harm. The third is the gift of inspiration, or the will to win, which is, of course, essential to initiative.
Do you believe, Mr. Carnegie, that gifts of money from parents to their children are helpful?
The answer to your question depends entirely upon the circumstances of the gift, the amount, and for what purpose the money is intended. It is the duty of parents to give their children an adequate education. All gifts of money beyond this requirement may be, and often they are, more harmful than beneficial. You may safely assume that any gift of any nature to anyone at any time, which has the effect of destroying an individual's desire to earn money through his own initiative, is definitely harmful. It is unfair to children for their parents to destroy their desire for personal achievement by gifts of money, which make it unnecessary for them to prepare themselves to earn their own money. Parents who wish to dispose of money through gifts would be much wiser if they donated it to some charitable cause rather than giving it to their own children.
What about gifts of money from a husband to his wife? Is this sort of gift advisable? And if so, to what extent should such gifts be made?
Here again, the answer depends entirely upon the circumstances of the gift. In the first place, you must remember that husband and wife are partners, and as such, the money provided for the wife by the husband does not always come under the heading of a gift. It is generally an equitable distribution of jointly earned and jointly owned money. In many instances, the wife aids the husband very materially in the accumulation of his money, and therefore has a right to share it. However, there are circumstances under which the marital relationship is damaged by too much liberality. This tendency sometimes leads to the spendthrift habit, which may lead to financial embarrassment of both the wife and the husband. Under other circumstances, unrestrained liberality develops vanity and idleness on the part of the wife. Likewise, where the husband withholds from the wife a reasonable share of his income, his action may create resentment and lead to misunderstandings. There is no fixed rule that will cover all marriage relationships with reference to the manner in which the husband and wife share the income. This is something that must be settled by the application of that most uncommon thing called common sense.
What about the gift from an employer to his employees? Is there any safe rule by which such gifts may be made without damage to anyone?
Some of my fellow workers have received as much as $1 million in 1 year in the form of bonuses over and above their regular salaries. This money was not a gift. It was compensation for services rendered beyond the amount of service these associates agreed to render in return for their salaries. You might say it was pay for their having gone the extra mile. Every man working with me is given an equal right to render that sort of service, and every man who exercises this right is compensated according to the value of the service he renders. The only thing that is really given, therefore, is an opportunity, which is equally available to all.
Then you do not believe in indiscriminate gifts to employees merely because an employer has converted his experience and intelligence into profits through the exercise of his own initiative?
No, I do not believe in indiscriminate gifts to anyone for any cause whatsoever, with the exception of donations to charity, for the benefit of those who are unable to earn money for themselves. Let me give you an example of what may happen through gifts that have no relationship to individual equities in the gift, upon the part of those receiving it. An acquaintance of mine, who is the owner of a very prosperous business, decided, at the end of a very successful year, to distribute 50% of his profits to his employees. He gave the money to them in equal amounts, regardless of the quality or the quantity of service each employee had rendered. 3 months later, he was waited upon by a committee representing his employees, which demanded that he raise everyone's wages. Upon his refusal, the whole group walked out on a strike, which cost him all his profits for the entire year and many thousands of dollars in addition. You see, human nature is a queer sort of thing. His employees reasoned that if he could make them a voluntary gift which they had not earned, he must be making so much money that he could afford to raise their wages. It is both unsound and unsafe for anyone to give money that does not carry with it some sort of challenge and obligation. If this employer had known as much about human nature before he made the unconditional gift to his employees as he learned about it afterward, he would have distributed the money under some sort of an understanding which would have obligated his employees to give something, if nothing more than a promise to render better service than they had been accustomed to rendering. You see from what I have said that the person who accepts something for nothing may be damaged as much as, or more than, the person from whom he receives the gift. It is always safer to give favors than to receive them, for the receiver of unearned gifts thereby places himself under obligations that may prove to be costly, to say nothing of cultivating the desire for something for nothing.
Mr. Carnegie, are your ideas concerning human relationships shared generally by the leaders of industry?
Yes, I think they are. You see, leadership calls for many qualities of character, some of which I have described. Among those is that of a well-developed sense of observation of details. To be an able leader, one must know how to negotiate with others with a minimum amount of friction. One must also know how to distinguish between human faults and virtues. These are basic requirements for leadership. Therefore, it is safe to assume that any leader of men would know, for example, that unearned gifts may do more harm than good. Also, an able leader knows that the most important link that connects him with his followers is that through which he inspires them to act on their own initiative. An able leader knows how to multiply his own capacity by inspiring others to act on their own initiative. In this manner, a leader may be at many places at one time. He may do many things at the same time and do all of them well. Take the leader of a large industry, such as the United States Steel Corporation, for example. Where would he be, and what would he do if he did not know how to delegate responsibilities to subordinates with full assurance that his plans would be carried out the same as if he personally attended to the details? He would be sunk before he started. While we are on this subject, I wish to emphasize again the importance of one's being able to get others to use their initiative to the fullest. It was this ability, more than any other, that enabled Charlie Schwab to become so indispensable to me. It would be no exaggeration of the facts if I said that his large income was his reward for his ability to get others to do things as well as or better than he could have done them himself. Let me emphasize one idea. Men in the higher brackets of income are paid for that which they can get others to do, not merely for what they know or what they can do individually. I doubt there is a man living who is worth $1 million a year if he were paid only for that which he can do individually.
It is generally known that you have helped many of your employees to promote themselves from positions of ordinary day laborers into positions of great responsibility, from which they became very wealthy. Will you describe the qualities of major importance which these men possessed that caused you to recognize them so generously?
There was no particular generosity connected with any promotions I have made among my associates. Such promotions as were made came through the efforts of the men themselves. I had very little to do with it. But to answer your question frankly and directly, I will name the qualities through which my associates promoted themselves. 1. The unvarying habit of going the extra mile without being requested to do so. I can say truthfully that this habit was the quality that first attracted my attention to every man I ever recognized through promotion. I can go still stronger by saying that without this quality, a majority of those whom I have helped to become wealthy would still be performing ordinary manual labor right where they started. It has always been one of my ironclad rules never to lift a man into a higher position or pay him more than the usual wage scale for his services unless and until he deserves recognition by voluntarily going the extra mile. 2. Proven ability to accept responsibilities and discharge them with a minimum of supervision. 3. Well-established ability to induce others to use their own initiative through the delegation of responsibilities. As I have stated, I would prefer a man who can get others to do things and do them well to one who has only the ability to do good work individually. 4. Loyalty to associates. A disloyal man is a poor bargain at any price. He is not only a poor investment from the viewpoint of the service he performs, which generally is little enough, but he is a great liability in connection with his influence on those around him. One disloyal man in an organization of 1,000 men will make his disloyalty felt and expressed throughout the organization. 5. A positive mental attitude. A man with a negative mind will, likewise, discolor the minds of all with whom he comes into contact. Therefore, he is also a poor bargain at any price. One thing that is essential for success in any business is harmony among those who do the work. There can be no harmony under the influence of men who carry chips on their shoulders. 6. A natural willingness to work. There is no function, no matter how great, that can take the place of work. I can say truthfully that every man who has ever held any sort of supervisory position in my organization worked harder than any man under his supervision. The man who tries to shift all his work to others will never be an able leader in any calling, no matter how much he may know or what other qualities he may possess. 7. Persistence. The man who is a good starter but a poor finisher does not possess the necessary qualifications for leadership. 8. Preparation. The man who guesses instead of knowing will not make an able leader. 9. Definiteness of purpose. The man who cannot make up his mind what he wants and stand by his decision does not possess the qualifications of leadership. Here you have the 9 qualities which, more than all others, have enabled my associates to promote themselves into positions of indispensability. If you analyze any successful leader, I believe you would find that he has these same qualities in some measure. Naturally, those who are more proficient in these qualities become the ablest leaders. Of course, these are only a few of the qualities desirable for leadership, but they are the musts, without which no one will become a noteworthy leader.
You have said something about the habit of exercising personal initiative. Is this not one of the musts of the leadership list?
Yes, and it belongs near the head of the list, but you must remember that the man who has the habit of going the extra mile naturally acts on his own initiative. I did not mention this quality because it is a part of the working equipment of all who do more than they are paid for. Unless they act on their own initiative without being requested to do so, it may be assumed that they are weak on personal initiative.
What about honesty? Can a great leader be dishonest and get along on his other qualities?
No one who is dishonest can be great at anything. Least of all can he be a great leader. But you will find that if a man is loyal to his associate workers, he is more than apt to be honest in other ways. Loyalty, you know, is one of the highest and most commendable forms of honesty. A dishonest man will not by nature go the extra mile. I am delighted that you have asked all these questions, for you have given me an opportunity to set you right on questions which others may wish answered in detail. I also like your questions because they are intelligent questions. And I like them because they show that you have a keen sense of understanding of the importance of accuracy and details. This, too, is an essential of leadership. The man who knows how to ask intelligent questions will, more than likely, know what to do with intelligent answers. I have often said that it is a greater achievement to be able to ask intelligent questions